problems there.
Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, good morning, everyone. The good thing is it's cloudy outside. The better thing is it's not raining outside, and that's fantastic. And we have a very powerful show today. I have the authors of Dishonored and Forgotten, Larry and Carolyn Farrell Watts. And if Detective Blitzner committed suicide, he's the only person who ever killed himself twice. George White, federal narcotics agent, wrote that on the front of this powerful book that I'm going to post my review with a lot of stars when this is over. The authors teamed together to write this fictional account of historical events surrounding a police narcotics scandal. In 1953, the Houston Police Department was rocked by corruption at the highest levels. I'm going to tell you more. This is a very powerful story. Carolyn is a counselor and specialist in school psychology, has written several Reading and Learning Together books for children and parents, and this is Larry's seventh work of fiction. This is fantastic. Good morning to both of you. Nice to have you here.
Good morning, Fran.
Thank you for having us.
I am honored, seriously. When creating this novel, what kind of research did you do, and why did you decide to bring this story to light? And I'm really glad that you did.
Well, this is a story that I had heard anecdotal accounts of throughout my career with the Houston Police Department. And about 3.5 years ago, Carolyn and I were bumming around in Galveston, Texas, and found a book of short stories that had a short account of this scandal in it. And it started us on our quest to find out as many facts as we could about what actually happened. So our research began with that book, which, by the way, was very well footnoted. And so it gave us a real starting place with magazine articles and other work. I then spent weeks in the Houston Public Library getting copies of all of the articles regarding this issue. Then we found that this federal agent, George White, was just a bigger-than-life character. There had been at least one book written about everything that he had accomplished during his life, and we learned that upon his death, his wife had donated all of his papers to Stanford University, and we were able to work with the Stanford University libraries and got copies of all of his notes relating to the Houston investigation.
That's amazing. So you came to know about that Martin's death and apparent suicide. What made you realize, and anyone else realize, that he didn't kill himself, that maybe it was something else?
Well, all the way, as I said, I've heard anecdotal accounts of this since I was a young police officer in the late 60s. And when any other officer would mention this, they would always say, and the detective committed suicide, and it would be kind of with a nod and a wink. It was somewhat of an open secret within the police department all these years that many people never believed that this was a suicide, primarily because when he was found, he had two bullet wounds in his heart and a nasty gash on the back of his head where he had probably fallen against a steel file cabinet. But it was as if it was an open joke that it had been ruled a suicide.
Well, why did they? Didn't they look into it any further? They just automatically assumed it was a suicide without doing any other kind of investigation, even though they realized there were two bullet holes? That's scary.
Well, it is, and it might lead one to believe that there was another agenda. Those who read the book learn that some high-ranking officials in the Houston Police Department were in all likelihood involved in taking narcotics that had been confiscated and reselling it to street dealers. And as a result, Bill Nitzer, the man who was killed, had within hours before his death, had met with the federal narcotics officer, and there is at least speculation that he was giving information about this narcotic scandal.
That's scary, because I wonder if one of them actually didn't take him out and they just don't know it, which is even more frightening, because that could really happen.
That's
right. Creating Bucknick, yeah, that's what's scary, right?
That's right.
So when creating Buck Nichols to tell the story, why a fictional character?
Well, what we learned after all of our research was that there were still really major gaps in the story, and we decided that we would make it a fictional account, and I was unable to find anyone in the police department who had actual knowledge of what had gone on. There were at least three officers who had been around at that time, but none of them were directly involved in this. So we created Buck Nichols. He's just a figment of my imagination, and his participation in this story, it's somewhat of a story of self-redemption for Buck Nichols, because at the time that his fellow officers decided to go to the federal authorities with their tale of corruption, he, in the book, chooses not to go with them. So all these years later, we used him to tell the story as he recalled it, and there's a little self-redemption for him in burying his soul about what happened.
That is, it was really interesting. You know, once I got the book, first of all, it has large print, so that made it even better, seriously. And second of all, I sat down, I just read it. And that doesn't happen too often, where I just sat down, and once I started reading it, I go, oh my God, did this really happen? And I just wanted to see in the ending. I couldn't believe, give it away, but I could not believe that ending. So why did Jason, a.k.a. Michael, his nephew, want to learn the truth? Why was he so bent on finding out after all this time?
Well, what occurred was that right around 2001 or 2002, the real Michael Bilnitzer's father was very old, and he had spent his life disputing that his brother had committed suicide. He was a Lutheran minister, and they had many reasons that they believed that Bilnitzer did not commit suicide. So his son, this would be the nephew of Martin Bilnitzer, the detective, decided to do research himself, and he did a considerable amount of research and eventually sent a letter to the Houston Police Department basically on the 50th anniversary of his uncle's death, and asked them to reopen the case and to classify it as a murder instead of a suicide. Unfortunately, it had been 50 years, and probably rightfully so, the police department declined to reopen the investigation. They just told him in a letter of response that there was no new evidence to dispute what they had concluded 50 years earlier.
Well, I take it there's no one, that since it's 50 years, that there will be no one there from the original case that would be there, or maybe whoever it was would be really much older and wasn't going to change their mind. That's the sad part. And the fact that they didn't want to reopen it tells me that there's something strange that was going on and still going on, and I wonder if they're still doing the same thing.
That's scary. That's an interesting point. Over the years, there have been several narcotic scandals in the Houston Police Department, but in fairness to the Houston Police Department, there have also been similar narcotic scandals throughout the United States in larger police departments. So I don't think that it's necessarily unusual. I could find no reason to believe that it was one continuing scandal. The police chief who was in office at the time had to step down as a result of this. He was never charged with any crime. And our conclusion was that probably he was more a victim of the circumstances than an active participant. But his assistant chief and his captain over the narcotics division, most people believe were heavily involved in the selling of the heroin.
That's scary. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's not just the Houston Police Department, but other ones too. After you can hear, it's scary. So Martin was shot twice, 2 gunshot wounds to the head, and a nasty laceration. From what the justice of the peace, the Emmy, related, it was ruled a suicide. Why didn't he, why didn't he realize that? Why didn't he look into logistics of the death and what happened? Was it really feasible? I mean, didn't the Emmy realize that there were gunshot wounds and he didn't do anything about it? He just felt that the way the shots went, he didn't realize that it could have been anything but suicide.
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than that. First,
yeah.
there was not a medical examiner at the time. This was about 2 years. Houston and Harris County put a professional medical examiner in place. But at the time, Justice of the Peaces, who are the in Texas, I guess you would say the lowest ranking judges. They don't even have to be attorneys in Texas to be elected to be a justice of the peace. And they had a very, I guess the best word to use is incestuous relationship with the police department. And so I suspect that this JP was probably in collusion with those who wanted it ruled a suicide. And by the way, the ruling came just hours after Billnitzer's body was discovered. So there, in effect, there was no real investigation into the death. Now, George White, the federal agent, brought some forensic people in from New York and tried to recreate with test firing weapons and a number of things. And his conclusion was that, and he was very vocal about it, that it could not have been a suicide, that it was a murder. But his problem was that he was a federal narcotics agent, and he had no authority to investigate homicides anywhere, but specifically in Houston, Texas. He, of course, tried to get the local authorities to reopen the case. But he, by the time he had such a bad relationship with them because he was accusing them of corruption that they ignored his requests.
In fact, That's they tried scary. To have him credited.
Go yes, on. They. It's a very interesting. George White could be a novel. Of his own, just his life.
That's what I'm thinking.
He was in the predecessor to the CIA and just during World War II, he actually was in the business of ferreting out both Russian and Chinese communist spies. And he was very colorful. He kind of got his claim to fame in the 40s when there was a Senate investigation. It was called the Kiefhofer Senate Committee of police corruption and the mafia. What's interesting is this was during an era when J. Edgar Hoover was denying that there was organized crime. And when the Senate committee asked him to provide an investigator for their committee, he declined. And as a result, George White, who worked for the Federal Narcotics Agency, held his hand up and said, "Let me." And as a result, he was the chief investigator, and he got some notoriety as a good investigator, and it enhanced his career. Now, when he started this investigation in Houston, of course, the administration and the police department did everything they could to discredit him. And one of the things they did, they tried to tag him as a communist himself. Now, they obviously didn't do a very good background check because he had a long career of ferreting out enemies of the United States during the war. So it's a very, as I said, that could be a book just about George White in itself.
Well, he was an amazing character, but what really got me was my next question. The story you stated in the forward in the fictional account of what happened to Martin, who was a real person, the detective who was killed as described in the previous question. The second person, Bill Poole, was a police officer who reported the possibility of a narcotics scandal, and he came forward. And how come his career was ruined? Because he brought a can of worms, and obviously they didn't want to hear it, so they destroyed him and put him someplace else. That was really upsetting. So why was he dishonored?
Well, it's very interesting. Bill Poole, by the way, was a William Poole was a actual character also.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is we started this book and we titled it Dishonored and Forgotten because we felt like Martin Billnitzer's life was dishonored and most people had forgotten, they wouldn't even know who he was, what the name would mean nothing to them. But as we did our research, we really came to the conclusion that there were probably two other people that may have been as great a victims or maybe even greater than he was. One was his wife, who never remarried and was in and out of mental institutions for years after. And Carolyn did quite a lot of research about the family background and came to the conclusion she was at least as much a victim as Martin was. The other was Bill Poole. By all accounts, he was a police officer who would tilt against windmills. He was a little bit of a Don Quixote, but he saw what he believed was wrong and what I think everybody would come to the same conclusion. And he decided that he wouldn't put up with it. He first went to the district attorney, and he's quoted in one of the newspapers of the time as saying that the district attorney told him that he couldn't live with what was going on. He needed to get another career. So now some of this might have been corruption from the district attorney, and some of it might have been different agencies not wanting to prick the skin of the police department just for political reasons. But at any rate, he decided to go to federal authorities, and that's what got this investigation going.
Yeah, I'm reading on page 162. The book is in front of me. And he was fired. And then the captain, this total officer of 21 officers, less than 24 hours after it was announced that Chief Poole had been fired, and he was a good police chief, they loved him, 14 of the officers resigned because of it, and it left 7 to police the city. That's unreal loyalty. Why did they do that, and why didn't they reinstate him after that? I'm reading this, I'm saying, how could they, you know, the man was a fantastic police chief, and everybody loved him, so they retired. That's dedication. That's unbelievable. So why did they do that?
What happened was, to put his firing and his stint as police chief into perspective, he was a patrolman in the Houston Police Department, and he was fired on what many thought were trumped up charges at the time, and he never came back to work in Houston. However, George White, the federal narcotics agent, had relationships all across the United States, and he got Bill Poole's job as the police chief in North Las Vegas, Nevada. And when he was attempting to get the job, the assistant police chief in Houston wrote a letter to the mayor and city council in North Las Vegas and tried to discourage them from hiring him. The management of the Houston Police Department hated him, seriously hated him, and some of those people followed his career once he left Houston and did everything they could to have him fired everywhere he worked. And in North Las Vegas, Nevada, of course, it was a small police department. It was apparently about 20, I don't remember, did you say 21 or 23 officers?
Yeah, 21 officers, yeah, resigned.
Yeah,
and then they left seven left.
When I found those articles from the North Las Vegas Sun about this, I was amazed. I've been in and around law enforcement for well over 40 years, and I've never witnessed another story of police officers standing up for their police chief like those 14 officers did. It was just amazing to me. Had to be in the book.
I know that made a difference, but he went to prison for this too, Bill.
Well,
and that
yes,
got me angry. I got really upset that they. I mean, he got a job in the library, but I said like they arrested this guy, didn't do anything, and that's what gets me.
Yes,
well, to me, it's like wrongly accused. Why?
Well, it was a very unusual case. This was in the 1950s, and although there were civil rights laws on the books, the FBI rarely investigated police officers. Usually, and I can tell you personal experience, if they got a complaint, they would come the local police department, and they would tell the officers, we've read your report. I'm assuming you don't have anything else to say, and that would be the end of the investigation. But in this case, they pursued him on a complaint of brutality that wasn't filed for several months after the arrest was made. And we came to the conclusion that some of the officials in Houston had managed to get some of their friends in the FBI to pursue him on this. And as a result, he was convicted of abusing the prisoner and sent to the federal prison for a year. Now, what's really amazing, and you can read this, and you have read this in the story, today, if a police officer was sent to federal prison, that would be the end of his law enforcement career. Bill Poole spent his 1 year in prison, came back to Texas, and was a police chief in at least two other small cities. And when he died, after having published our book, we found his death certificate. And when he died, his occupation was he was a police officer at the time. So he had a long career after Houston and after spending a year in the penitentiary. I suspect that Bill Poole was happy about the fact that he managed to stay in law enforcement and do the things that he thought were right.
There are so few people like that in this world. That's amazing. So I'm looking at this, too. At the end of the book, they talk about Captain Melton. And what part did he play? And I have a whole bunch more questions.
Sure. Captain Melton was the head of the narcotics division. And he, in my opinion, was probably the most corrupt person involved in this. He was fired.
Okay, reading.
Yeah, he was fired by the police chief, but he got his job back. And then two or three years later, he was fired again for bribery. And that time, after years of court cases, he settled by retiring and taking his pension and going to work for the Harris County District Attorney's Office, which is where Houston is located. Interestingly, a few years after he went to work at Harris County, one day he came in on an airplane flight from some business out of state, got in his car and drove to the Harris County Courthouse and shot and killed himself.
Oh, wow.
Sitting in his So I, again, came to the conclusion that maybe just all of the things he had done throughout his career and the misery that he had visited upon other police officers, that maybe he had enough conscience that he conscience that he just couldn't live with it any longer.
I can imagine. It's too bad that he did it and he didn't have to kill himself. But I'm sure that there are people in the world that still do the same thing. That's scary.
That's correct. I have interviewed a number of people who knew some of these characters. I have never interviewed anyone that was in the police department or around the police department who had a good opinion of Captain Melton. Most everybody believed that he was corrupt, with one exception. There was the daughter-in-law of the police chief who believed that he was a good policeman. Of course, she wasn't directly involved in this and barely knew him. But at any rate, most people had a very low opinion of him.
That's scary. That the fact that they had a low opinion and they didn't do anything about it right away, that's even worse. But
that's right.
Sometimes people in powerful positions, unfortunately, get away with a lot more. And if you, like Bill Poole told on whatever happened, he had to pay the penalty for that. That's scary. So
that's right.
There was tape. That's what I'm saying.
Well,
God, that's scary.
I was going to say that's kind of why we created Buck Nichols, that many times people just don't have the courage to stand up and say that's wrong. And that's kind of the portrayal of Buck Nichols, that he ultimately did the right thing, but only when he was put in a corner and had to.
That's the problem with this world, too. Everybody's so afraid, and if you see something, you're supposed to say something. And you never know how many lives you could save by saying something. And you just don't. I mean, I taught for 36 years, and if a child came in and said, my mother hit me, or they had black and blue, I reported it. I'd rather be wrong, and I was never wrong. So if you see something that's wrong, and I saw abuse, and I reported it, you never know whose life you're going to save. And maybe sometimes the parents could get some help. So there is no excuse not to speak up. I don't care. So how helpful were the tapes that were created?
Well, what happened was that, of course, this was, I would say, it was in the early years of voice tape recording. And George White tape recorded the interviews he did with Houston police officers, including the two interviews that he did with Martin Billnitzer. Now, when the police department ruled Billnitzer's death a suicide, the police chief made a public statement that, in effect, George White had driven Martin Billnitzer to commit suicide because he had threatened and abused him. Well, keep in mind that George White was a very boisterous, outgoing person who loved the news media and loved the spotlight. But when Chief Morrison made these allegations publicly, White had very little to say, which was unusual. But about all he said was, well, I don't understand why they would think that, because I had two interviews with him and they were very pleasant. And of course, the police chief, said no, that Billnitzer had told him that he was afraid that White was going to send him to prison. Well, White let this go for a couple of months, and he let the tension build. And then he went to the U.S. attorney and to the foreman of the grand jury, and he took the tapes he had of Billnitzer, and he played them for these people. And then he told the news media that they might ask these people what they thought of the interviews. And of course, both of them had to admit that both interviews were pleasant, and actually one of them even said that you can hear Martin Billnitzer even laughing and joking with Agent White during the interview. So he made the claims that he had driven Martin Billnitzer to suicide just totally false. And so the tapes played a major part in proving that White did not abuse the man before he committed suicide.
That is scary, but they didn't do anything about to change the fact that he was never honored to die in the line of duty. That was even scarier. So when the lead investigator's file had personal letters from officers involved in the case, documents generated by the federal government employees, and the crime scene photo of him lying dead on the station floor, why didn't they investigate more? Why didn't they realize that this man was murdered? Maybe somebody in the department did it, and yet they didn't do anything about it.
Well, I think the answer is that because the people who were in charge of the investigation were the same people who were involved in the corruption. And even though George White tried very hard to have something done about it, all of the Houston officials were in bed together. They were not going to reopen the investigation at the time. In part because some of them were involved in the corruption, and in part because they all had come to hate this federal agent who came to town and accused their heroes of corruption.
I'm surprised they didn't try to take him out too.
Well, they did, not physically, but they file complaints with both the FBI and with the Treasury Department, which is the agency that the Narcotics Bureau was under at the time. And they accused him of being an alcoholic and having all kinds of personal problems. But none of those complaints ever got anywhere. Although I will say that my research of George White confirmed that he was actually a very high-functioning alcoholic. As a matter of fact, there was one that he would drink a fifth of gin during the day in martinis and then go to meetings in the afternoon, and no one would realize that he'd been drinking all day. Very high-functioning.
I could just smell it and I get sick. Forget it. I don't drink at all, but just the smell of it gets like, oh my God, no, I can't stand this. So where did George White's papers wind up, and who gave them to be donated and why? And yet that still didn't change anything.
Well, his papers, of course, after he left Houston, as a matter of fact, he's quoted in one newspaper after the investigation was over and he left, that he wouldn't live in Houston, Texas, if they gave him every oil well in Texas. He really was bitter about what he had found here. But he went on to work primarily in California, although all over the world. And he ended up in a small community in California on the beach, and he was he spent his last years as the beach patrol for this community. And his wife actually donated the papers to a smaller regional college, and that college realized that those papers were probably better suited for a library such as Stanford University. And by the way, I will tell you that I was very impressed with dealing with Stanford University libraries. I was able to do everything over the phone. They looked up my research, found two thick files with personal notes with just lots of information about this case. There were actually letters that Bill Poole had written to George White after they were both gone from Houston, and they obviously had a real friendship. So it just very interesting papers.
That is interesting. So I'm wondering, because of your career and the background in the police department, and because you called the Stanford Libraries, if anyone else had called to ask for help for research, was it because of your background, or was it because they were just, you know, help somebody writing a book? So I'm curious to know that, because when, you know, other people ask for police consultants or firemen or anyone like that, they don't always want to, you know, give a lending hand. So was it because of your background that they did that, or because they felt that the story needed to be told?
Well, actually, it wasn't because of my background, because in all of my conversations with the librarian, I never revealed who I was, what my background was. I told her that I was writing a book about, you know, this account, and she was just, they were very helpful in bringing to look up the his papers and to pull out the papers on Houston, and so it had nothing to do with my background. I just believe that library is very customer friendly.
That's fantastic. That is great, because the library up here is not quite as customer friendly. If you ask them to help out or something like that. I put some of my books in the library when they were having a sale, and they're good. They're children's books and other books, and they look at you and said, "I'm just giving them to you. You don't have to pay me or anything." They don't take everything. The librarians are very hoity-toity, you might say. And yet, everyone that's read the book, my children's books, think they're wonderful. So you just never know. So you interviewed the daughter-in-law of the then police chief and the relatives of officers who were involved or working in the police, Houston Police Department. Was there anyone there that helped or that realized that something wasn't right with this whole case and that Martin didn't commit suicide?
Well, unfortunately, with one exception, the people who were on the police department at the time were really old and unhealthy, and I didn't try to interview them. Mm. I did interview one man who told me that he had carried notes between the police chief and George White, who set up an office in a hotel here, but nothing of any substance. Now, interestingly, I did a presentation at a retired police officer's meeting in Houston where there were about 125 retired officers, and I got some interesting anecdotal accounts of what they had heard. One man swears that one of his partners, who is now deceased, told him that the day that this happened, that they saw another officer run down the stairs and run out of the building right after the shots were fired. Another officer believes, and he believes it because of stories he's heard, that the young officer who was sitting in the office when Martin Billnitzer came in just before he was shot might have been the one who fired the shots. But in both cases, those anecdotal accounts, and I didn't put great emphasis on that just because, you know, they were anecdotal. You know.
That's too bad. I wonder what would have happened if somebody actually believed that and did something to investigate to find out who really did it. Because it just sounds like they just covered the whole thing up. That's what really is sad.
I believe that's exactly what happened.
Friend, I can make it a little bit personal for you. Billnitzer's wife was a first grade teacher, and she didn't want him to be a policeman because of the danger. And the night, the day he was killed, they were planning to have a youth party at their home, and he'd called her and talked to her and told her, wanted to know if she had everything ready for the youth party. They were still working with the Lutheran Church, which was his background. His father was also a minister. And she had everything ready, and they were happy, and he'd tell her all of, that everything had gone well in his interviews with White and also with his supervisor, and he'd tell her about it when he got home, and within the hour, he was dead.
That is scary, because if that happened, then why wouldn't they realize, or why didn't she realize he would never kill himself? There'd be no reason to.
Right.
And that's what bothers me. Yeah, no one. There's no reason for that. Oh, my God.
It's a very sad story.
I cried at the end of it. And in the
oh,
middle
goodness.
Of it. You know, there are very few books that, you know, touch you or whatever. But it's sad. But this really needs to come out, because if you just listen to the news and how many police officers are getting arrested for corruption, I mean, it's mind-boggling, and they're supposed to take care of you, and you're supposed to trust them. As a result of the many blog stories that you and Carolyn were contacted by the great niece of a drug dealer and pimp who played a huge role in the downfall of the police chief, sending a police officer and a doctor to prison. How did that happen? I found that very interesting.
In preparation for the release of our book, we did a number of short blog stories about some of the things that the book would contain, and among them was a story about a pimp and drug dealer in Houston by the name of Earl Voice. And he was the drug dealer that the authorities were selling the heroin back to. And so I did a story about him. He was a very interesting character himself. But after posting that story, we received an email from a lady who said she was his niece. And she asked to meet with us because she wanted to know. Actually, she was doing some genealogy work on her family and wanted to know more about what we knew. So we met with her. The book was already in print at that time. It had not been released yet. But at any rate, she told us that during her genealogy research that she went back to the neighborhood, which is in downtown Houston, where the narcotics was recovered that they sold back. And some of the people that still live there remembered her uncle, Earl Voice, but they warned her, whatever you do, you don't need to be looking into this because the police will not like that. And one of the reasons she wanted to meet with us was to get our opinion on whether we thought there was any danger. And I told her, I certainly hope not, since we're publishing this book. Mm. But that's now well over 60 years ago, I assured her that I didn't think she had to worry about that. Interestingly, though, she told us that the narcotics that was recovered had been buried in the backyard of a house, and her uncle, Earl Voice, was known to bury both his narcotics and his money in the yards of houses that he owned, and he owned a number of houses. He invested his money. He was an unusual dope dealer. He was apparently not a user, but he invested his money in real estate and had a number of houses that he rented. And over the years, people who knew about this have gone to those houses and dug around the backyards trying to find anything that he might have buried. And, of course, she told us that as far as she knew, no one had ever found anything. But apparently it is still kind of urban legend that some of Earl Voice's money may still be buried at some of those homes.
I'm sure somebody's going to find it someday. So before I forget, on a Tuesday of next week, New York Times author Stephen Manchester will be here with a heart-wrenching story about two brothers that finally got together and their journey due to a will left by the father. It's very interesting. The title is Ashes. On the 4th, King Grossman will be here with letters to Alice. And this one, the week after, is like exciting, really exciting. On the 8th, I will be interviewing New York Times author Brian Freeman. Marathon, what happens when a Muslim man is wrongly accused of setting a bomb in the Duluth Marathon and his life is ruined because he really didn't do it? And the next day, I am totally shocked and so totally pumped and excited. The head writer of Murder, She Wrote will be here, Tom Sawyer, to talk about his two memoirs. And on the 11th, Kurt Cam, Code Blood. So I am really excited. And there's plenty more where that came from. And, of course, for those of you that want a good book to read, Dishonored and Forgotten is a fantastic book. And, you know, holidays are coming up, Mother's Day, Father's Day, and any other day to give a present. And this book is powerful, and I really think everybody should read it. Silent Source is another one. And the one I just finished yesterday, Without Warning, by Joel Rosenberg. And Operation Scorpion is another one that's fantastic. And All Consuming Fire by Donna Crow Fletcher. And those I just finished this week alone, seriously. So, how did you create each of the meetings between Carson, Nicholas, and Jason? And how did you create those meetings between all of those people?
Well, there is a restaurant in Houston called the Dot Coffee Shop, and it's on the Gulf Freeway between on the south side of town. And ever since the 60s, police officers have been going to that coffee shop, especially on the night shift. They used to go there because it was one of the places that was open 24 hours a day. And so we thought that it was appropriate that Buck Nichols would go there because he was familiar with it. And so we decided to have him live in that neighborhood. And so he and Carson Foshi, who was also a retired officer, who in the book, he kind of puts the nephew and Buck Nichols together, and that's how the story is told, is the three of them meet, and they ask Buck questions, and he tells them about what happened back then. So we wanted it to be in... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, we wanted it to be in southeast Houston, which we live between Houston and Galveston and are very familiar with this area. And that is the southeast part of Houston is where I spent much of my police career. So it by placing them in this area, it required a little less research on the geography than it would have if we'd placed it somewhere else in Houston. So I must admit that we did it because we got a little lazy.
Well, actually, characters, though, initially the book was more of a narrative with someone like Buck telling the story, and we believe that we need to bring it more alive for today. And so Larry had been talking to Michael Belnitzer, the nephew, and most of the characters in the book, their names are used, but we didn't use the names of anyone who was still living. And Jason Belnitzer actually was kind of based on him and the anguish he expressed when he was trying to find out, when he was trying to have the truth come out about his uncle, because his father was dying of multiple sclerosis and he wanted his father to go to rest with some peace of mind about his brother. So I kind of based Jason Belnitzer loosely after him. And you write about things you know. I placed part of it in Galveston, because I'd been to a counseling conference in Galveston, and it was a wonderful experience. So I made Jason's wife a counselor who was at a meeting in Galveston. And Galveston has some memorials there that I think were also inspirational about why we feel like Belnitzer needs to be on one of the police memorials, because it in the book he's jogging down the seawall and he sees this wonderful memorial base that is dedicated to the survivors of the 1900 storm, horrible hurricane that killed so many people. and also to those who died, the families who died. And he starts thinking, well, if there's a memorial like this for all the victims and those people, why can't my uncle be on one as well? And we're hoping eventually that would happen. It may not, but at least it's brought to light in the book. And I have to say,
Carson with you.
Is based on my husband. I created that character because he did so much research, and I kind of loosely based it on my husband, and I like that person very much.
Well, I can imagine. You know, I mean, they built a 9/11 wall to the people that died. And that was tragic, and one of them happened to be one of my students. So, he should really be up there. Yeah. I felt like, because what you just said, Carolyn, you're right, you needed the dialogue, and you needed to bring it into today's kind of writing. So I felt like I was living the story again as you wrote it. So
well, thank you.
I can tell. I don't know if I feel like that.
Carolyn will have to take credit for that, because she is the person who actually developed the characters to a much greater extent than I did.
But Larry did all the footwork and the real story. So it was fun writing together. We'll do it again.
I hope so, because I can't wait to read the next one. So if Martin could speak to us right now, what would he say, and what would he want you to know or try to do?
I'm sorry, if who could speak to us?
If Martin could speak to us right now, what would he say, and what would he want you to know, and what would he want you to do? Would he want you to keep on trying to prove that he didn't commit suicide? What would he say to everyone if he could speak out?
Well, I think if he could speak out, it's the only way we would likely ever know exactly what happened, and I believe that that's what he would tell us. I also believe that he would appreciate that his family spent the rest of their lives, his brother, trying to prove his innocence. And I believe he would be proud of his family for having done that, and for having put so much information out there that someone decided to write a book about it.
He might say,
is there anyone left in his family? Is there anyone left in his family?
Yes, it's he has at least three nephews who live, at least one of them lives in Ohio. And that's Michael Bilnitzer, and he has Michael has two brothers. So there are some now. Martin and his wife had no children, so there were no children from their marriage.
Martin also might what he might say would be based on his favorite job in the police department, which was educating youth and adults who fell in the dangers of drugs. And he was one of the earliest people who were in such a program, and he'd probably say, now see where these drugs led this situation? There's all kinds of dangers involved in it.
That's fantastic. They have something up here in New York called the Explorers Program, which is for youth that are difficult. And that's fantastic, too, that anybody that could work. I worked with difficult children in a public school in the Bronx, and it's amazing what you could do if they really think you care. So what about his family? It was tough. And I was the dean, and I had a lot of obstacles. Like, he had obstacles there. My principal didn't want to hear it sometimes, and I just said, well, you're going to hear it because I'm going to do it anyway. Because if a child is in trouble and they need somebody to listen, we got to make sure that they really did what they said they did or didn't do. So what about his family? Are they going to keep trying, or is anybody going to try to ever get him on that wall and exonerate him?
Well, I think that his nephew has pretty much expended all of his energy on this cause. We have some slight hope that someone will read this book, and that they will start insisting that he should be on the wall. One of the problems with that is that the police department where the line of duty death takes place is responsible for determining whether it was a line of duty death or not. So it's still back in the hands of the Houston Police Department. And at this point, There's no indication that anyone within the police department has any interest in pursuing that.
So maybe this
maybe need to send them a dozen copies. Maybe they need to send them a dozen copies of the book to read.
Well, we've actually sent some copies. We'll see whether it has any.
What about to the district attorney's office or the attorney general just to send copies? Or what would your target audience be if I put it out on my site, which I'm going to do, that if anybody, you know, read that, I'm going to put it on my Facebook wall in about 10 minutes. And I really think that police officers like need to take a long, hard look at themselves when something like this happens. And the fact that there's so much corruption everywhere and everything, it's scary. So who would be your target audience if you could get other people to read the book? Who else would you want to read it besides the Houston Police Department that should really take the blinders off?
Probably, we intend to send some free gratis copies to some of these people, but probably mayor and city council in Houston and state legislators and Congress. Because there's not only a memorial in Houston, but there is a state memorial in Austin, Texas, and a national memorial in Washington, D.C. But the first step is to get the death ruled a homicide instead of a suicide. And so it all starts locally.
What did the media do? Did the media think it was a suicide? Did anybody in the media think that maybe he was killed? Nobody in the media?
Well,
usually there's one news reporter that goes after it and won't stop until they get the truth. Was there anybody?
There was one reporter for the Houston Post who basically wrote very mocking stories about the police department and its investigation. Mm-hmm. But other than that, as a matter of fact, he called them in one of his editorials. He called them the Keystone Cops of Houston, you know, and he talked about how inept that investigation was. But that's the only news media that I found that seemed to take a position. I'm not sure that back in the 50s the news media was really as aggressive as it is today.
Yeah, sometimes the media slants things the wrong way, and sometimes they slant it the other way. But every news station delivers the same story, but in a different way, through their own light or how they're told to present it, which is even worse because you don't get too many commentators that tell it the way it's supposed to be told. So what is next for you and Caroline? And I'm glad to see that you're going to pursue this as you're not going to let it go. And what's next for both of you? What are you going to write together that I'm going to read next?
Well, we are still trying to decide. One story that we both have some interest in is, as you may know, Texas. Some people in Texas believe that Texas can secede from the Union,
and
both of us believe it would be very interesting to write a story about what would actually happen. If these people who hate our United States government were successful, we think probably that Texas would be taken over by the drug lords from Mexico. And we think that would make a very interesting story that might end up with those very same people that wanted to secede begging the United States to take them back. So we're thinking about that story, but that too requires a lot of research, so we haven't decided for sure yet. Carolyn is finishing up a children's book, and I am finishing.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm finishing the fourth in a series that I've done. It's called the Tanner and Thibodeau series, and it's just purely fictional. A couple of private investigators. So we're doing that, and then when we're through with those two projects, we're going to consider this secession book.
That sounds interesting. Steve Berry's Lincoln Myth is about that. It's interesting. His research in there deals exactly with that.
Right.
And I know, but I interviewed him on Monday. Yeah, he's fantastic. So where can everybody, folks, Carolyn, if you read Children's Book, you've got to send it to me. Children's books are my favorite. And my niece, who's 9, is my book partner. So all I have to do is review the book, and her hand is out. She grabs it before I can even say it. And for her birthday next week, I will interview you based on your children's book. And her birthday is next week. Penelope's going to be 9. I can't believe it. And she called me up and said, "What are you getting me for my birthday?" I said, "What would you like?" A bag of books, and I do. I've got a bag of about 30 books that she wants to read that were on her wish list. So that makes me so proud to know that there are kids out there that actually read, and they should. So where can we learn more about you and your work?
Well, both of our websites are fairly easy to remember. Mine is www.larrywatts.net, and Carolyn's is carolynwatts.net, and our books are available there, or they're available on Amazon, or as I always say, wherever good books are sold.
That sounds fantastic. Well, I want to thank you both for today. This has been one of my most enlightening and best interviews ever. This is fantastic. You have to send me one of your crime books, one of your fiction mystery murder books. I love those. Those are my favorite. And you've got to send me the children's book when it's done, because children's books are right up the top of my list, and that's fantastic. I want to thank you both very, very much, and I'm going to email PJ. I'm going to put your review out with some powerful statements on my Just Review site. I want everybody to know that I am really excited that I have been placed in the 2017 Yellow Pages of Book Reviewers. That is like,
wow.
I couldn't believe it. Yeah, that's a big deal. I was like, oh, my God, they asked me to be in there again, and I'm really proud. I'm under there as Just Reviews, which is my review site, and it is a sanctioned review site. Otherwise, they would not let me. There's about 200 people in there, and I am very proud to say that I am one of them. And I want to thank you and Carolyn. This has been fantastic. I want everyone to know that Mother's Day and Father's Day are great ways to say thank you to somebody. And the best present to me in the whole world, is a book. And I read the author's note that Harry Billitzer passed away on January 24, 2007. And Martin, it's sad. And I really hope that listening to this, that maybe the police department in Houston will wake up and realize that they need to honor this man and his death. So thank you so much. Everybody have a great day. Carolyn, Larry, thank you a million times. And I can't wait to read your next one. You're welcome.
It's a pleasure.
Everybody
thank
have a great
day. You bet.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. I need to finish getting ready.